Today I'd like to take merely 1,200 years of church history and put it within a contemporary framework. So, small tasks. This is the second session in our overall session on a theology of work. And today I want to zero in particularly on the context within the Christian tradition and particularly within the Lutheran tradition, in which I think we can understand the Christian's role as a Christian at work in the world today. And to start and set that context, I would like to set the contemporary context in terms of three books that I have found helpful in terms of thinking through some of these concepts and getting me to think about work and why the Christian church, why theologians, why Christians need to think about it more. The first is a book that's been out for quite a while. It's Turkle's book called Working, which is just filled with interviews that he does of workers in all sorts of occupations, from doctors and lawyers and teachers to bank tellers, garbage collectors, prostitutes, sports players, newscasters, you name it. Turkle interviews them. But a few of his comments in his introduction, I think, are interesting, provocative, and some things that we need to think about. Turkle writes, "This book, being about work, is by its very nature about violence. Violence to the spirit as well as to the body. It is about ulcers as well as accidents, about shouting matches as well as fist fights, about nervous breakdowns as well as kicking the dog around. It is above all, or beneath all, about daily humiliations. To survive the day is triumph enough for the walking wounded among the great many of us. It is about a search, too, for daily meaning as well as daily bread, for recognition as well as cash, for astonishment rather than torpor. In short, for a sort of life rather than a Monday through Friday sort of dying." Another comment by Turkle. He says, in terms of coming to some kind of conclusion, "Perhaps it is time that the work ethic was redefined and its idea reclaimed from the banal men and women who invoke it. It is a world of cybernetics, of an almost runaway technology. Things are increasingly making things. It is for our species, it would seem, to go on to other matters, human matters. Freud put it one way, Ralph Hellstein puts it another. He is president emeritus of the United Packing House Workers of America, and he says, learning is work, caring for children is work, community action is work. Once we accept the concept of work as something meaningful, not just as the source of a buck, you don't have to worry about finding enough jobs. There's no excuse for mules anymore. Society does not need them. There's no question about our ability to feed and clothe and house everybody. The problem is going to come in finding enough ways for humans to keep occupied so they're in touch with reality. Our imaginations have obviously not yet been challenged." Another book that is a source for some of my thinking is a book that came out by Robert Bella and others called Habits of the Heart. And basically, again, it's a sociological study of white kind of yuppified America and the values that are there in that particular perspective. And again, as as Bella looks at these things, he notes that by and large, the prevailing value for people is individualism and self-interest, self-happiness. The difficulty with that value is that it has no underlying values. It's simply based upon one's own personal preferences and choices. And Bella sees that to be problematic in terms of a nation built simply on personal preferences and choices is really no nation at all, because the whole understanding of community or coming together has been lost. And as he summarizes some of these things, he says with regard to a person named Brian, he says, Brian's description of his reasons for changing his life and of his current happiness seemed to come down mainly to a shift in his notions of what would make him happy. His new goal seems as arbitrary and unexamined as his earlier pursuit of material success. Both are justified as idiosyncratic preference rather than as representing a larger sense of the purpose of life. With regard to God in all of this, one of the prevalent understandings of God when it comes through in terms of these personal preferences is a statement, again, expressed by Brian, where he says, quote, I want to be in control of things, and I figure God put me on earth to take care of myself and not do God's work for him. I'll leave the big problems for him to solve. Little ones I'll solve for him. Kind of a new updated version of God helps those who help themselves. One other book that deals again with work, society, and values is a book entitled Fragmented Gods by Reginald Bibby. And this is a book that entails basically 20 years of sociological surveys in the Canadian context. And Bibby notes that within Canada, the gods are fragmented. And the reason they're fragmented, from Bibby's perspective, and here he relies on much of what Bella has done, is that in contemporary society and culture, where individualism and personal preference are the keys to one's life and one's understanding, religion becomes very problematic because, after all, religion tries to be a system of the whole, to try to provide some unified sense of meaning within all of one's life. And in a culture and society that are fragmented, that's a very unpalatable kind of understanding. No one has time for or really wants to work with the wholes. So rather than having a whole, you fragment them and simply pull out the pieces you like. And Bibby uses this to explain, for example, while on the one hand, church attendance is down and people aren't attending churches, most folks consider themselves religious. Most folks have not changed their religious affiliation. If their grandparents and parents were Lutheran, they're Lutherans too, although they may not have gone to a Lutheran church for 5-10 years. Or if you're Roman Catholic and your parents were Roman Catholic, you are too. And you only go to church for, again, those special fragments in your life. You go to church for births, for baptisms, and you go to church for confirmation, and for weddings, and for burials. Other than that, church is unnecessary because, you see, it doesn't fit into my kind of personal preference and option. The conclusion that Bibby comes to in all of this is as follows. He says, again, here's he's speaking about Canada, but I think it fits with the United States as well. He says, the people of this country are in no sense abandoning the supernatural. On the contrary, they give every indication of readily embracing a wide range of supernatural practices in the course of supplementing scientific explanations. They choose fragments, not because there are no system options available, but rather because they are no more conducive to life in our present age. Fragments are thriving. Consumers are wanting them, and religious companies are obliging. But the gods are becoming increasingly silent in Canadian life. The reason is simple. Religion has always claimed to bring something from beyond to culture. The gods, so believers have claimed, have spoken to us about life and death. However, when religion is drawn upon in accordance with the whims of customers, the gods are dismantled. They are custom-made according to individual taste. Rather than looking to them for direction, we direct them, as if we were ventriloquists and they our dummies. When religion becomes nothing more than a consumer item, the customer is in charge. The gods, relegated to an a la carte role, have little to say about everyday life. In Canada, the stability of religious affiliation is matched by the poverty of religious significance. Okay, with that is kind of the societal cultural overview. I think that one question that we as Christians have to ask ourselves is, how does a Christian live and work in the world, particularly in a world where the aims of the society seem to run counter to the call of Christian discipleship, right? Where the aims of society, which say there really is no connection between Sunday morning and Monday morning, run counter to what we as Christians would still hold to as some notion of the whole. So how do we answer that kind of question? And it seems to me that two theological resources that we can use are St. Augustine from the 4th century and Martin Luther at the time of the Reformation. And just kind of weigh as historical, biographical note, Luther starts out as an Augustinian monk, so that theologically, if Luther knows any theologian well, Luther knows Augustine. So we can see how Luther and Augustine work nicely together. A little bit about Augustine. Augustine dates are 354 to 430. And Augustine is living in a time when the Roman Empire has its greatest difficulties. In fact, the Roman Empire is just about ready to fall or has fallen. And at one time in this period, Rome is sacked by the Huns, by the barbarians. And so it seems like all of society is falling apart, that all of society is fragmented. And within this fragmented society, all sorts of people are saying, who are we going to depend on to deliver us? Are the Roman gods going to come through? Are the Greek gods going to come through? Are the barbarian gods going to come through? Is the Christian God going to come through? All of those kinds of questions within this notion of fragmentation. And within this context, Augustine tries to give a picture of the whole of what is the Christian's calling, the Christian's responsibility within society. And in order to do that, he relies on some of the things that we looked at yesterday for biblical support, Genesis 1, 2, and 3, Matthew's or Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, particularly Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and also the Apostle Paul, and particularly Paul in the book of Romans and a little bit of 1 Corinthians. So looking at Genesis 1, 2, and 3, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and Romans, Augustine comes up with this kind of systematic picture. He notes that the human relationship takes on two different dimensions, a vertical dimension and a horizontal dimension. The vertical dimension talks about the relationship, and we should have arrows going both ways, the relationship between God and ourselves. And he understands this relationship to be seen in terms of faith. Faith, the faith we have in God, and also the faithfulness that God exhibits toward us. Right? The faithfulness of a God who creates and the faithfulness of a God who redeems. So there is this faith relationship. That's the vertical dimension. The horizontal dimension is the relationship between ourselves and the other. And Augustine would say, biblically, again, that relationship is seen in terms of love. Or here to use the Latin root word caritas, our word charity. Charity is not, in its traditional understanding, is not simply giving alms to the poor or helping somebody out that has it rough occasionally. But caritas or charity is the whole lifestyle of love. It is the kind of response that we as Christians have toward the other, have toward the neighbor. And here again, for Augustine as well, the neighbor is particularly other human beings, but it's not solely human beings. The other also involves creation. Picking up a little bit about what Dan Erlander said this morning about Ephesians, that the way people like Augustine read Genesis 1 is that Genesis 1 is not the beginning of the story, Genesis 1 is the end of the story. After you read the whole scriptures, Augustine says, then you understand what Genesis 1 is all about. That's where God is taking us. That's where God is taking us, to that perfect creation, that perfect order, that perfect harmony, which is yet to come. And that order and harmony embodies again the relationship of faith and love. And the Christian's calling in life is a calling of, and here he uses Paul's phrase, the phrase from Galatians, and a phrase which Luther, as a good Augustinian, is going to pick up and really go with, that notion of faith active in love. What is the Christian's calling and the Christian's responsibility? It's faith active in love. In other words, in your work, in your life, you are the person in whom both of these dimensions are at work simultaneously at the same time. And although they're at work simultaneously at the same time, you also do not confuse the two. In other words, you do not place faith in the other, you do not place faith in yourself, you place faith in God. You see, because if you place faith in the other, that or faith in yourself, that's the problem. That's how we get into sin. And here is where Augustine interprets Genesis 1, 2, and 3, again, particularly Genesis 2 and 3, and to diagram that, he would say, okay, here's what it's all about. God creates human beings. So the human beings are to be directed toward God, to have their faith toward God, to seek as their end and their final goal and fulfillment God, to desire God above all things, right? First commandment kind of talk. That's how things were in Genesis 2. In Genesis 3, sin enters the picture. And instead of this willing faith toward God, this vector is now changed, or as he would say, the human will is curved in upon itself, such that now we are no longer God-directed, we are no longer God-centered, but now we are self-centered. And that is the basic condition of sin, self-centeredness. Redemption then comes into the picture where Jesus comes, and Jesus' role of redemption is to grab that self-centered will, that self-centered vector, and what? Straighten it back out so that we can once again be God-centered. Anakephalaiosasthai, right? Recapitulation. Re-straightened out the way God had it all set up in the first place. Augustine liked that word too. I don't know if he could pronounce it, but he probably used the Latin, recapitulato. But that is his understanding of redemption, that what redemption does is restore that relationship we had with God. And that's where things are going. So what we have here, Augustine says, is two things now because of the world of sin or the condition of sin. We kind of have two things going on at the same time. We have a self-centered kind of life going on, which he uses as a metaphor. He calls this is what's happening now in the earthly city, and then there is also the God-centered life, the redeemed life that we have in Christ, and this is what's going on in terms of what he calls the city of God. And he writes a great big long book entitled The City of God, where he tries to map out all of these things and note the contrast. Here in the earthly city, again, the primary understanding is that of self-centeredness. In the city of God, in the world of God-centeredness, here is the understanding of grace and redemption. Over here, one has a setup. Augustine notes that this is particularly run by coercion. This is the world that is particularly run by grace, and it is over here where one has freedom. Because freedom, as understood by Augustine and by Paul and by Luther, is not simply the ability to choose, but freedom is also almost understood as a place or location. It's a whole set of conditions in which one is, by which one can make choices. Over here, to just make choices, Augustine would always say, within the self-centered realms of things, all choices we make are always going to have some degree of good and bad with them, because of that whole self-centered category. Now, given that kind of understanding and that kind of setup, the question is, where does work come into all of this? Where does the Christian vocation come in? Is work part of our self-centered life, or is work part of our God-centered life? And Augustine, like all good theologians, answered that question, yes. In other words, it's both. Right? Where is our work? Yes, it is self-centered and it is God-centered. It's that kind of ambiguity that comes into play. He bases his answer on the text from Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 17 to 24. Note that, 1 Corinthians 7, 17 to 24. And I'll read that for you. Paul writes to the Corinthians there, "Only let everyone lead the life which the Lord has assigned to him, and in which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. For neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. Everyone should remain in the state in which he was called. Were you a slave when called? Never mind. But if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. For he who was called in the Lord as a slave is a freed man of the Lord. Likewise, he who was free when called is a slave of Christ. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. So, brethren, in whatever state each was called, there let him remain with God. Augustine's ambiguity from this, based upon his understanding of Paul, and again still the context in which there are particularly slaves, is saying the notion that, yes, our work, our calling, for example, a slave, which no doubt about it, you know, there are slaves. Why? Because of self-centered existence. Yet, paradoxically or ironically, one can carry out one's work, one's calling as a slave in a very self-centered system in what? A very God-centered way. Because, as Augustine would say, after all, we know, given this setup, that although the self-centered world may say, oh, you're a slave, we know that as a Christian slave, we are truly free because we are living this kind of relationship with God and with one another. So there's the kind of ambiguity that comes in. Let me stop here just for a minute to see if you have any questions or comments about that, particularly in understanding the two dimensions of this relationship in the self-centered over against the God-centered way of living, because this will come in for Luther. Questions?
Yes. Could you expand on your comment about freedom a little bit more? And
okay.
Not just being something,
right,
but being a place or having
right.
more responsibility.
What Augustine understands by freedom in terms of a locality is an understanding in terms of how does one stand before God? In what state or condition is one in before God? And what he's saying here is that, for example, within the human self-centered, sinful condition, we have no freedom because each and every decision that we make is still bound within this self-centered category. In other words, we cannot be truly free to choose anything because we are always bound and under the constraints of this kind of self-centeredness, this self-preservation, however you want to label that. So here we're always under the kind of notion of choosing between the lesser of two evils. Over here in this understanding of freedom, what Augustine says is because one lives the God-centered life, one is not under these kind of constraints of coercion, nor is one even particularly caring about the self. Yesterday, the self-centered existence, as we noted from Matthew chapter 6, is what leads to anxiety. You know, the anxiety of, oh my goodness, what am I going to eat? What am I going to drink? What am I going to wear? Is everybody going to like me? How am I going to be a success? Right? And there Jesus says, well, you know, look at the, Birds of the air don't care about that. Lilies of the field don't worry about what they're going to wear, and they were far more beautiful than Solomon ever was, and that kind of don't be anxious stuff. You see, that's the kind of coercion, the lack of freedom we have due to anxiety. Today we call anxiety stress. And it's that same kind. Over here, the anxiety, Augustine claims, because of faith in God, is gone. Because if, and here we slide into Luther a little bit, Luther's understanding of the first commandment, if faith is understood as fear, love, and trust in God above all else, if we so totally and completely trust on God to take care of us, then what? Then we are free for loving the other. Because self-interest and self-centeredness is no longer a concern. And in that choice, and in that situation, in that kind of locale or condition, Augustine would say, now one is truly free to choose because there are no constraints.
What motivates someone in this system to seek change, either for self or other, in a system where whatever you're in, it doesn't matter because God is already there and He's freed you. So you've got the best of both worlds right there. Okay. Why do you need change?
Sure. The way you change, what is the impetus for change is love and love of the other. Because you see, the reason that there's going to be change is because the other may have needs. And if it is incumbent upon you, in terms of loving that other, to meet the needs of the other. In other words, change from this kind of perspective, and this is something that Luther really picks up on, change comes about because of what happens outside of yourself, what goes on outside of the community. And again, Luther too picks up on the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus kinds of things. What is change? Well, you have two coats and your brother or sister doesn't have any. What do? Right? There's got to be a change there in terms of what? Give your brother or sister that extra coat. Right? Now, did you say that by some kind of internal decision, oh, I have two coats. Gee, what should I do? I better think about this. No, right? It's the external situations and conditions that determine that. And so Augustine and Luther takes that. It's again, really the neighbor that determines the change. If you're sitting back, you know, fat, happy, comfortable, and all around you, your neighbors are starving, Augustine and Luther would say, hey, we need some changes here. If we're sitting around living well, but at the same time, all creation is going to pot, air, water is polluted, scarcity of resources, all the good things that Jerry is talking about. What? That external, right? The whole groaning of creation, to use Romans 8, is telling us, hey people, we need some changes here. Same with the issue of racism, same with the issue of the handicap. Jerry?
This diagram, human, God, and curled. Mm-hmm. Becker, how does that change post and anti Good Friday?
Well, I think here the understanding in terms of how Good Friday comes into this is that Good Friday is the historical concrete event which enables this to happen, both anti and post Good Friday.
What to happen?
The change in the turning from self-centeredness to God-centeredness.
So, post Good Friday, it's possible to begin to unwind. Is that the point?
Yes, but I would say, and Augustine would want to say as well, this is also possible pre-Good Friday, in terms of when Christ redeems the world, when Christ redeems the whole cosmos, it's not just from that moment, 3 p.m. April 14th, 27 A.D., but that also has a retroactive effect in terms of all people who have always looked at God, acknowledged God's grace, and responded in faith, that God-centeredness was there too. I mean, that the kind of thing that Paul says about, by faith Abraham believed and it was accounted to him for righteousness. How is it possible that God would account Abraham righteous? Concretely, historically, Augustine would say it's possible because of what Jesus did on Good Friday. But that was always already the case for Abraham way back there when Abraham was doing his thing. So it has that retroactive effect, or one would say almost cosmic effect, for Augustine's understanding. Yeah, time kind of messes this up a little bit, and Augustine has a problem with time.
Physicists do too.
So do physicists, but in book 11 of Augustine's Confessions, he starts out, "I never thought there was any difficulty with time until someone asked me, 'What is time?' And I couldn't answer them." Right, and then, again, because of this, how does time fit in? And he has very much a problem with time and history, particularly that retroactive notion. But at the same time, he knows from the scriptures and God's promise that grace is given and sent and there for all. So he knows that to say, well, it just started on Good Friday is a very bad answer. Bad oikonomia, Dan would say. So it has to have this retroactive effect. Okay, any other questions, comments? Luther comes into this, and he says that, okay, Augustine talks about the two cities, the earthly city and the city of God. And he says, well, I like a lot of what Augustine says here, but I'm gonna kind of shape this up a little more and see if I can help get rid of some of this ambiguity regarding work. And so the metaphor that Luther adopts, it's called the two kingdoms or the two realms or rules. And Luther says God works in the world in two ways: the kingdom of the left and the kingdom of the right. Okay? And with regard to the kingdom of the left, what Luther wants to say about the kingdom of the left is that the kingdom of the left is there for us in order to, first and foremost, check self-centeredness. And the way you check self-centeredness is through a system of reward and punishment. Why don't you drive 105 miles an hour in a 35 mile an hour zone? Especially if you're in a hurry and very, very late. Is it because you have ultimate love and concern for the neighbor, or because you don't want to get that tremendously expensive ticket, or maybe even hauled to jail? Or how do we stop drunk drivers? By telling them, hey folks, shape up, love your neighbor. Or do you tell drunk drivers, you get caught driving drunk and there's going to be big fines and we're going to take away your license and there may even be a stiff jail sentence with it. And so you figure, oh, I better watch my drinking and my driving. Right? Luther would say, that's the kingdom of the left. It's there to check self-centeredness. It offers reward and punishment. It also works with rewards about how do you get people to do things they don't want to do. Offer them incentives. That's how money comes into the system. You know, you do this and I'll pay you for it. That's the whole systems of rewards, punishments, incentives to check self-centeredness. That is, as Luther understands it, the primary working of the kingdom of the left. But he says, in the way that the kingdom of the left works, we have to remember that what the kingdom of the left does, the bottom line in all of this, is that it compels self-giving. And here you can see he's using Augustine's notion of coercion there. Right? It compels this. This isn't done out of freedom. This is not necessarily done because you want to. It's done because you have to. And one example that Luther used is still a good example, right, is taxes. How many people want to pay their taxes? Or especially as much as they do. Or how many people want to say, oh yeah, I know I owe the government $5,000, but this year, they're such good folks, I'm going to give them $6,000. The Pentagon's in trouble. They need my help. Right? How many people want to pay more than they're supposed to for taxes? No, IRS compels us to pay taxes. And, you know, one would hope for good causes, but that's another issue, right? But that's how this works. Over on the other hand, with regard to the kingdom of the right, here Luther understands that the kingdom of the right is that which works under the rubric of grace or giftedness. It operates in terms of freedom, and instead of compelling, here's the area again of love. You do things because you want to. And Luther's understanding again of this is that while one may distinguish between the left and the right, one should never separate left and right. Because indeed, he would say, the kingdom of the left, this compelling and coercion, is minimally what you need to exist as a society. The kingdom of the right is the optimum or the maximum kind of understanding that says, indeed, when the kingdom of the right is at work, all of the stuff that should be happening in the kingdom of the left is already incorporated into it. So it's not that left and right are in opposition to one another. But it's that you gotta have the left simply to survive. You have the right if you want to live in Genesis 1 kind of world. Peace, harmony, fullness, shalom. A loving kind of situation. And of course, when you have the loving situation, what? Self-centeredness is checked. There is no kind of compulsion for self-giving because loving is, if you will, voluntarily giving of the self based upon our faith in God. So that the compulsion is left, but all the benefits that come from it are there. So that Luther can write in one of his works, the Freedom of a Christian. He says, the faith and the Christian station are so free a thing that they are bound to no special orders, but are above all orders, in all orders, and through all orders. I mean, it's almost like a sacramental understanding. As he talks about the sacraments, he talks about Christ's body and blood being in, with, and under the bread and wine. Here he's understanding that when faith and love are at work, that means it is in, with, and under everything that we do within our life. so that it would be, so that the kingdom of the right would be so much in with and under the kingdom of the left that it simply incorporates the left right into the kingdom of the right. Again, wherefore, there is no need for you to take up or leave any station in order to be saved. It is all free. Free. And because of this, Luther can write later with regard to the understanding of the Christian and the Christian's position. He says, if you are a craftsperson, you will find the Bible placed in your workshop, in your hands, on your heart. It teaches and preaches how you ought to treat your neighbor. Only look at your tools, your needle, your thimble, your beer barrel. That's what I like about Luther, right? Your articles of trade, your scales, your measures, and you will find this saying written on them. You will not be able to look anywhere where it does not strike your eyes. None of the things with which you deal daily are too trifling to tell you this incessantly, if you are but willing to hear it. And there is no lack of such preaching, for you have as many preachers as there are transactions, commodities, tools, and other implements in your house and estate, and they shout this to your face. My dear, use me toward your neighbor as you would want him to act toward you with that which is his. Thus, Luther's understanding of vocation is simply the concrete way one carries out love of neighbor. And in order to carry out that love of neighbor, that means God gives you everything within creation to do it. And so everything within creation that carries out love of neighbor is, Luther would say, not only permissible, but God-pleasing. And Luther just loves to go through the whole gamut about that means you can be prince and priest, husband, wife, son, daughter, stable boy, maid, in typical crass Luther ways of talking. He says that the stable boy shoveling manure is praising God as much as the priest on Sunday morning. And so you kind of have to wonder, I wonder what the priest is shoveling on Sunday morning. Luther had that in mind too. But right, Luther would make no distinction. There is as much glory and there's as much praise in cleaning out stables as there is being the pastor of a church. Because both of them serve the neighbor and therefore serve God.
That's a point that has troubled me some. Because I go from the beer barrel and its contribution toward creating alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And I go from that to perhaps not looking at the beer barrel, but looking at your cigarette making machine. And the role that has in creating cancer. Or to looking at your Hustler magazine. Or to looking at your stock of cocaine.
In other words, are cocaine growers carrying out service to the neighbor? Is the kind of question that comes out of this.
Well, it seems to me that that part of Luther's writing doesn't raise any question about whether certain vocations that we can recognize now as existing in society in fact do demonstrate love. It seems to be that whatever vocation you have, that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that at this point in time, the church has to be raising some questions about the choice of vocations that people make.
Yes. And it has. It has, Luther has as well. In his understanding, at his time, the exceptions he would make to vocation, but his criteria, or basically only one, his criterion for that is that it did not exercise love of neighbor, but if you indeed was self-centered. There were three occupations that were, he would say, not God-pleasing vocations. Thievery, prostitution, and can you guess what the third one is? Because this would be a dramatic change from today. Banker?
Usury.
Yeah.
Usury. Yeah.
Collecting unfair interest, or some may have even said any interest, on a loan. Those were not God-pleasing occupations because what they did was take advantage of the neighbor or foster simple self-centeredness. And I think today, as we would look at other vocations, and particularly, if you will, vocations, jobs, occupations which were unfamiliar to Luther, like the cocaine grower or the drug pusher. Right. One may even want to go as far as a case like the person who works in a nuclear munitions plant, assembling nuclear bombs. Are those God-pleasing occupations? I think Luther would say that's something we need to look long and hard at, and that's something the church has to talk about. Because if one says that these do not promote the love of neighbor, but take us right back into the, you know, demonically self-centered kind of existence, then indeed that is not God's will. And therefore is not that kind of vocation that serves the need of the neighbor. Because if it doesn't serve the neighbor's need, if it's not the love of neighbor, then it's not vocation. So that's a good point, Jerry. I mean, that's the whole realm of ethics within the church, to look at those kinds of questions.
Is Luther, in essence, then saying that we're put here to serve others?
Yes. That's how he understands Genesis 1 and right on through. In fact, to talk most specifically about vocation, and here vocation is from the Latin word call, about the call, and somewhat controversial and particularly within a more pietistic understanding, because many people think about the call in terms of that's some little internal message or sign that very personally and privately comes to you from God. And I know, particularly teaching at a seminary, worked with a lot of students in seminary who are really wrestling over, do I have the call to be a pastor? You know, I haven't had that vision like Paul, or God hasn't called me in the night like God called Samuel. Can I go into the ministry? Should I be ordained? Where's my call? And again, from Luther's perspective, and again from the perspective within the church, that never has been the way God works in terms of calls. The calls always come from an external kind of source. Luther writes, and this is one of his sermons of 1522, vocation is not just nor primarily an inner feeling. In reality, it is bound up in our relationships with other people. These relationships with others affect our vocation, since these external circumstances have been set before us providentially by God. If you want to know what your calling is, again, look out there and see what are the needs of your neighbor. What are you called to be? What are you called to do? Don't sit around, you know, in your upper room waiting for the voice of God to come some night. Right? Look outside your window. Who needs your help? There's your calling.
I think two comments on this last little bit. We're here to serve others. I just raise the question, does others in that case mean other human beings? That's one question, comment. The other has to do with this matter of waiting for a call. And I think a good bit of the reason why people have difficulty seeing the call or hearing the call is put before them is they pray too much.
Prayer, I agree with you on that, yes.
Prayer is, as we understand it today, in large part, a matter of putting petty little petitions in front of God. And the whole art, the whole craft, the whole discipline of meditation is virtually lost from Christianity. Yeah. And there needs to be far less prayer and a whole lot more listening.
Total agreement with you there. Yes, prayer is understood as how, again, for at least for someone like Augustine or for Luther, the function of prayer is to open us up to God and to others, not to close us in on ourselves. I think we've had again the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, when you pray, you know, you should go into your closet. That's been, I think, misinterpreted in terms of that means just go in and turn in on yourself. No, it means you don't brag about your prayer life. But it doesn't mean that it's kind of, you know, something where you close in on yourself rather than open up to God, others, the whole world.
Kind of deals with the anxieties that you were talking about. Yeah.
May I ask whether or not, as you see the two kingdoms, it is a matter of each individual deciding for herself or himself about conduct and about methods of accomplishment, and is not a matter of the function of the state and the function of the church?
I think Luther would see that in terms of both and. What he understands, and I think extrapolating from Luther into our contemporary understanding, Luther would say, indeed, there should be a separation between church and state in terms of institutionally. Right? And that you can find that in the Augsburg Confession between the temporal and spiritual authorities, and they're supposed to be doing different things. But while there is that institutional separation between church and state, there is not to be a kind of pulling apart of the functions of religion and politics.
I can understand the use of coercion in the kingdom of the left if we're talking about a state. God favors either side in battles. I do not understand the kingdom of the left if one is talking about individual conduct. It seems to me that the use of violence in any of its forms is contradictory to what the kingdom on the right suggests is the way. In short, I could see kingdom on the left as being a poverty plan by God, institution of government to prevent chaos. And I can see the church's function. But if one tries to use the model, as I've been understanding, as being the way an individual makes his decisions and the way that an individual seeks to enforce them, then I've got some work left to myself to decide when I'm going to approach another man or woman and use violence to effectuate my objectives.
Yeah.
You're also right in the situation of the different gifts. And the decision as to whether your gifts apply or whether they don't apply, and whether to refer or not to refer, and our compartmentalization of professionalism, all of that compounds this stepping in and reaching your neighbor. Postpones it, kind of like prayer. Because it's a lot of distance.
And here, I think, is again a problem with contemporary individualism that Luther did not face. And Luther was still in a much more community kind of understanding where, again, vocation, if it comes about through the calling of the neighbor, the decision about, well, do I have the gifts to do this or not, is not simply an individual decision, but that's something that is, again, made in community. For example, one reason that he would say it is the church, right, a Christian community, which calls pastors. It's a whole bunch of people gathered together and say, hey, I think you have the gifts and abilities to do this. You should, you know, be pastor. Or a contemporary example, which I think particularly we as Lutherans need to learn more about. It's a good sense of vocation and calling. It's using the ecclesiastical ballot, which everyone says is just, right, a parliamentary nightmare because, you know, we got to vote 7 or 8 times for all of this. But what is it? It's the community getting together and saying, who are we, you know, understand as well, who is God calling to be our bishop? And so the first ballot really is, could be anybody. And from there you begin to narrow it down to see, well, what are the needs that we have? What is the needs in this area, this synod, if you will, and who has the gifts and abilities to meet those needs? And finally you come down to that one person who is then called to be bishop. And that person then decides to either accept or not accept that call. And we're beginning to understand that with bishop. Where we really don't understand it is when we elect the synodical secretary. Right? Everyone said, why should we have ecclesiastical ballot for the synodical secretary? I mean, that's just going to take notes or whatever. But no, again, if you understand it's the whole community calling. You know, a lot of people from that first ballot, they all want to stand up and say, oh, please take me off, I'm busy, I'm this, I'm that. I mean, I think, no, nobody goes off. Right? You go on there and you may be the busiest person in the world. And now if you're chosen to be synodical secretary, right, you have been extended a call and now you must make that decision, right? A tough decision. But now, what are the needs of the neighbor? How do I...